All right, well, thank you so much to the Buddhist Channel for inviting me to come and speak on Dhamma for you all today. And we agreed that an interesting topic to talk about would be what in the suttas they call sometimes the sentient body or the savijnanaka kaya. Most people are probably more familiar with the term nama rupa, which kind of has a similar meaning, but also maybe just a little bit different. And so I want to sort of discuss some of these issues and try to look at the, first of all, the sort of linguistic context, like what the texts actually say, and then maybe some reflections on the meaning and the context of those things, and then perhaps a look at how they inform our practice. Okay, so I'll start out with a linguistic discussion first, or just a discussion of what we find in the suttas. So in the suttas, especially in the Pali suttas, but also commonly throughout all the Buddhist suttas, we find reference to a somewhat intriguing term called nama-rupa. And nama-rupa is kind of an interesting kind of word. It's not an easy one to... Well, I shouldn't say that. As a translator, of course, one of my jobs is to try to render these things in English. And the problem often with translation is not that a word, the meaning of a word is obscure or difficult, but that sometimes it's too simple to translate. That's kind of often a big problem. Like nama rupa is actually two very, very common and very ordinary words. The word nama just means name. That's it. Very simple. And it means actually name in even in modern languages. It's actually etymologically the same as the English word name, which until a few hundred years ago in England was actually just pronounced nama. So that shift from the pronunciation of nama to name happened only recently. And I think nama is in Bahasa Indonesia, is nama mean name as well? Yeah, okay. So I mean, just I think it's really interesting to just stop and to just reflect at how amazing that is, that the same word, like literally the same word, with hardly even any variation in spelling or anything, means name in Indonesia and in England. That's weird, isn't it? Right? How does this actually happen? We sometimes forget how much these things change and shift over the world. Like, why is it that particular word had become so well known across so many countries and so many linguistic backgrounds? Now, let me just divert a little bit to talk about cows and fish. Okay. Now we have the English word cow. Yeah, and in Pali, the word for cow is go. And in Sanskrit, it is gava. And I'm guessing, not as somebody who speaks Bahasa Indonesian, but I'm guessing that there's probably a similar word for cow in Indonesian. Is that correct? What's the word for cow?
Yeah, in Indonesia, is sapi banti.
Oh, is it? So it's a different word.
Different word.
It's not word. It's not go. So it must be from the local languages. Okay, so, but in most of the European languages, the word for cow is derived from the ancient Indo-European word. And so is, for example, the word for horse, which in Pali is asa, so asva in Sanskrit. On the other hand, the word for fish in English, in Pali, is macha. Okay? So macha and fish have nothing to do with one another. They come from completely different backgrounds. So why is that? Why is it that some words for common animals are shared, but others are not? Well, if we think about who the ancient Indo-Europeans were, living in the Caucasus, in the middle of the huge continent of Eurasia, then for them, in their culture, cows were really important. Horses were really important. In fact, they were quite possibly the first people to tame horses and harness them to chariots. These animals were central to their culture, but of course they're living in the middle of the continent. Fish were not so important to them. Right? Fish were more important to the people living on the oceans, people in England, right? The people in in the shores in India. So they had their own local words for fish, but they all shared the word for cow because that was important to the ancient Indo-Europeans. Now, the reason I'm just making this point about language is that I think that the fact that the word nama is shared across all of these different places is not an accident. I think that it's because it was a word of special significance to the ancient Indo-Europeans. It was a word that had a deep meaning in their culture. Right? Now, this is speculative because, you know, we're talking about a lost culture that we can only infer from our modern sources. But I suspect that one of the features of their culture, and it's not just from this example, but from many examples, one of the features of their culture was that they were very interested in concepts. They're interested in ideas. They were interested in language. They were interested in what are the names of things. Perhaps this also has even to do with the fact that they spread out, the ancient Indo-Europeans spread out across so many of the world, so they encountered so many different peoples. And when you encounter so many different peoples, the first thing you do is you say, what's the name of this? We call this matcha, you call it fish. Oh, okay, we have a different word for this same thing. And so that kind of idea of understanding language and reflecting on language and the meaning of language, how language influences us. Yeah, this is something that tends to happen when people move and shift and encounter other people. So this is what I suspect is lying behind this. There was a concern, an understanding within the culture, long before the Buddha, understanding of this idea of somehow we're naming things, and naming things has this curious power that we understand things when we name them. I think about that. Like if you're walking through a forest or you're walking through something and you see a flower, oh, what's that? I don't know that. It's unknown. It feels like there's a distance from it. And then your friend says, oh, that's a hydrangea. That's a jasmine. Oh, now I have a name for it. When you have a name for it, you feel like you understand it. So that when you have a name for something, think about what happens. I see this flower. I don't know that flower. But I see it. Okay? I see it. That flower has a shape, it has a color, it has an appearance. But I don't have any concept in my mind that allows me to make sense of that flower. Yeah? And so when that happens, we feel a bit curious. There's a feeling of it's a bit unsettled. I mean, if it happens, if it's just seeing a flower, then never mind, right? But imagine that you were to be arrive in a foreign city where you didn't speak the language. And all of the signs, you know, imagine if I was to go to Japan or to China and all of the signs are in Chinese and I can't read any of the signs. I have no idea what anything is. And so you'd feel very alienated. You feel unsettled and disturbed. Right? So this lack of being able to conceptualize things makes us feel uneasy. So come back to the idea of the flower. So think about how that works. You have an image of the flower. You have a name for it. The image of the flower is the rupa. That's what rupa means. Rupa means an image, a vision, a shape, a form of something. So we have the form of the flower. Then we have the name of it. So we have the external physical thing and we have the internal representation of that thing. And when we have those two things, we feel like we understand. There's like a wholeness there. Right? We're living in a familiar world where I can make sense of things because I can name them. So this is one of the things which that idea of name and form is coming to. And so when we're understanding it from a linguistic point of view and from a historical point of view, This is why it's easy to translate the word name and form, because nama rupa just they're very simple words, right? So you can translate the words, but to try to capture the idea is very subtle, right? The underlying idea behind the idea of nama rupa is very subtle, and it's very hard to capture in a translation. So this is why I wanted to dwell a little bit on that idea of the name and the form as a concept, as an idea. Now, here's where it starts to get interesting. Think about, let's continue the flower idea. Let's consider say biology. All right. Now in biology, one of the great projects that biologists have is to classify everything. All the different species in the world, let's find a name for each one of them. Let's fit them into a taxonomy. Let's make them all fit together. So this is a process of naming. And they are continuing with that process of naming things so that we can understand the natural world better. Yeah? And that's still going on today. And it was going on in the time of the Buddha. So the people in the time of the Buddha wanted to understand things, and they thought that they could understand things by putting names on them. Yeah? And this was one of the ideas. So this is, and that's why this thing becomes an object of spiritual relevance. Because you don't really understand something just by naming it. Naming things is handy, it's useful, but there's a lot more to something than just the name of it. And often it can even be misleading, right? We think we know something because we know the name of that thing. And, you know, you can even see yourself how that can be quite reductive, right? So you might say something like, I met such and such a person, but, you know, that person likes putting pineapple on his pizza, right? Oh, that's so horrible. How could I ever be friends with a person who wants to put pineapple on my pizza? On his pizza? So as soon as you think that you've identified somebody like that, then you it's a way, it's kind of reductive. Like once you name something, you've created an illusion of understanding that stops you from going deeper into it and understanding the essence of the thing. Yeah. So you can start to see how this idea of nama rupa is actually a very pregnant idea. It's a subtle concept, but one which underlies a lot of our spiritual practice. Now, all of the things that I'm talking about were known about before the Buddha. The term nama rupa is a pre-Buddhist term. And these ideas that I'm talking about are already found in the pre-Buddhist scriptures that we call the Upanishads. And so just give a little bit of background here. So from a very ancient time in the Brahmanical culture in India, they recited these hymns called the Vedas. And based on those Vedas, they would do various rituals. And of course, Brahmins today still do this. A few days ago, as it happens, Venerable Akaliko and myself attended a vigil in the center of Sydney, which was held to remember the Indian people who are suffering under COVID and a very great tragedy that's unfolding there as we speak. And we went and we recited the Metta Sutta and tried to just express our support and our compassion because so many people are suffering so very much. Even one of the attendants at that meeting spoke about how she had on the train coming up there, you know, the tragic news that one of her family members had died. And so this is a terrible thing. Even like some of the senior Buddhist community members, the senior monk, Venerable Satyapala, has passed away a week ago from COVID. And so it's a terrible tragedy. Anyway, we went there to speak about this, and there was a Hindu representative there, and he recited the Gayatri Mantra, which is one of the central verses taken from the Vedas. So these things are still alive and very much a part of the living Hindu tradition. Now, if you are in a religious tradition, you often end up reciting things which have words, and just the recitation of them is considered to be something which is good. And of course, we find this kind of thing all through Buddhism as well. And I probably, for most of the people who have experience in Buddhist communities, I probably don't need to spell this out, but let me do that anyway, right? And a lot of times people go along to temples and they recite and they don't really understand what it is that they're reciting. They're just saying words. And they go, Panatipata veramani sikhapadang samadhiyami. And you ask them, what does Panatipata mean? And they say, I don't know, my mum told me to come. And so this is kind of the problem, right? Because it just becomes like it's just the name, right? It's just you can say the words and then it does. That's it. Now, the pre-Buddhist Brahmins were well aware of this, and a lot of the Upanishads talk about this, and they talk about the fact that if you do these rituals, it only really has meaning if you actually understand them in the right way. And one of the most characteristic phrases in the Upanishads is the phrase ya evam veda, one who understands this, one who knows this. That means one who, when they're doing those rituals, understands them correctly. Right? That's when those rituals will truly be fulfilled. So there's this idea already before the Buddha that there's the name of things and the form of things on a kind of surface level, and then underlying that, there's a deeper level of understanding. Right? So the Buddha took up this idea, inherited this idea, and then took it even further and developed this understanding of nama rupa and mind and body even further. So the Buddha talked about these things in a number of different ways and a number of different aspects. But one of the differences that he said from the Upanishadic doctrine is the Upanishad said, well, look, this underlying knowing, this what they call vijnana, is the fundamental, that is ourself. So once we've gone beyond the surface trivial name and form, we can go to the deeper underlying consciousness, and that is our true self. They use the simile, for example, of all of the rivers flowing down into the sea. Yeah? All of the rivers flow down to the sea. Each river has its own shape, its own rupa. Each river has its own name, its own nama. But when they come into the ocean, they lose their name and their shape, and the ocean is consciousness, and that is your true self. This is the Upanishadic doctrine, which was current in India a couple of hundred years before the Buddha, and which the Buddha criticized. And what the Buddha said, and if you just stop for a minute and you take back and look at that simile from a physical point of view, right? The vijnana is the ocean, which is permanent and stable and eternal and infinite. But of course, from our modern science, we know that that's not true, actually. The ocean might seem like it's infinite and eternal, but actually it's temporary and impermanent and conditioned. And the ocean is constantly evaporating. The water is falling on the hills into the rivers and then back into the stream. It's actually a cycle of conditions. And it isn't that the ocean is permanent and the rivers are impermanent. And that is very much like the critique which the Buddha gave against the Upanishads. He said that this thing that you call in consciousness is not permanent and eternal, but it too is part of that conditioned process, part of that cycle. Consciousness conditions name and form, namarupa conditions consciousness. And these are all part of that cycle, which in a physical sense, we would say is part of the cycle of nature or the ecosystem. And from a Buddhist sense, we would say is part of the cycle of dependent origination. Yeah? So I'm drawing analogies here between the way that nature works and the way that dependent origination works. I'm not saying that these are the same thing. I'm saying that there are similar kinds of processes that we can observe. And so the Buddha always looked at things in terms of conditionality and impermanence. All right. So this is giving you a bit of a kind of background as to how the Buddha is using these terms, nama rupa, and how they emerged out of that particular specific historical context. And I think that if we ignore that historical context, we will be tempted to misinterpret what the Buddha was saying through the lens of our own preconceptions. That's why it's important to try to look at what was the Buddha talking about in his time and place. Once we know that, then we can start to ask, what does that mean for us in our time and place? Okay, so nama rupa, the original meaning of it. So what I've been talking about so far is the original meaning of it, like where the word is coming from. But one thing that we often forget is that words are not static. Words don't just exist. Words are constantly changing. The meanings of words are constantly changing. So nama rupa isn't a word or a term with a meaning. It's a word or a term on a journey. Yeah, the meaning is changing gradually over time. And so if we want to understand it, then we have to look at, well, what does it mean to those people in that context at that time? And we should avoid the temptation of thinking that, well, it necessarily meant the same thing to everyone over all time. That's not to say the meaning is completely different, but it's just to say that the sense of it and the perspective on it can shift over time. Okay, so come back again to that basic idea of nama-rupa. Basic idea of nama-rupa is there's some kind of, nama is some kind of inner concept or idea. Rupa is some kind of a form or physical manifestation. Okay, now that applies to how we see the external world, but also applies to how we see our own world, that is to say, our own body. And so just as we can recognize that that plant has a form or that wall has a form, we can also recognize that our own body has a form, has a rupa. And very commonly in the suttas, we find that the word rupa is used simply in the sense of a body, right? This is one of the senses. So sometimes the word rupa means a sight, something that you can see. Sometimes it means any kind of physical phenomena. And sometimes it means body. And it's not as a translator or as someone who's looking at the suttas, it's not always easy to tell exactly what sense is meant in each context. I mean, usually it's clear enough, but sometimes there are some cases where you're not quite sure exactly what sense is, and maybe even that the Buddha was playing around with these different senses and that he meant it to be read from some different perspectives. So sometimes we find rupa used in the sense of the body. And in that, there's actually a number of words in Pali for the body. There's rupa, kaya, sarira, and so on. And they all have a slightly different kind of nuance to them. So when the Buddha was talking about nama rupa in terms of the body, then we're talking, then this is a more kind of evolved, slightly more evolved, more technical way of using the word, as opposed to the other more naive way of thinking about it, is just nama is the idea of something, the name of something, and rupa is the physical appearance of something, right? So we're moving towards a more sophisticated, more philosophical, more psychological understanding, no? And under that more psychological understanding, what it's pointing to is the fact that who we are, right, this what we take to be a person here, is somehow made up of these different aspects, that we have these conceptual aspects, we have this mind, we have thinking, we have ideas and emotions and feelings, and we also have this physical dimension. We have senses, we have a physical body, we have a shape, and that shape has its own memory, right? Each of our bodies bears the scars and the events that's happened to us throughout our whole life. And that shape, that physical shape, starts to manifest at conception in the mother's womb, and gradually it grows from there along with our mind, along with our thoughts and so on and so forth. And those two things are very intimately linked because, for example, in how your brain works, right? So when you use your brain, you think in a certain way. So there's a certain mental event which uses naming. So there's a nama there. But those mental operations, those mental processes, are also have a corresponding physical counterpart in terms of your brain and the brain activity. And also through your body as well. Like if you have an angry thought, then that affects your breathing. It affects the tension in your muscles or your body language. So our nama, how we're using our mind, and our rupa, how our body is, are constantly interdependent and changing. Yeah? Now, when the Buddha talked about this nama rupa as a sort of sense of the organism with its physical and mental aspects, he used a number of different terms to address this from slightly different ways. One of the words he used also, I mentioned at the beginning, is the word sarvijnanaka kaya, which literally means a body with consciousness or sentient body. And that's a word which is only found, I think, in one place. It's not a common technical term, but it's found in one place, and that context is independent origination. And the point there is that when we are reborn, our body, our physical body, comes together with consciousness. Right? It's already part of that thing. Our mind is already part of that whole kind of system. So there are a few philosophical issues which we can sort of tease out of the discussion so far. And I'll just make a few philosophical points before moving on to the discussion of how we apply this all in our practice. First philosophical point I would like to make is that in Buddhism, there is normally, or certainly in early Buddhism, there is normally a clear distinction between nama rupa on the one hand and vijnana or consciousness on the other hand. Okay, independent origination, vijnana pachaya nama rupa, the consciousness conditions nama rupa, and nama rupa conditions consciousness. They affect each other, they change each other, but they're not the same thing. So what the difference there is that nama rupa is the more active and conceptual side of the mind. Nama rupa is our thoughts, our ideas, our perceptions, and so on. Whereas consciousness is the awareness of all of those things. Right? Consciousness is the awareness of a thought. It's the awareness of a sight. Yeah? It's the Buddha said consciousness is like the lord of the city, which sits in the middle at the crossroads. And it's like the consciousness receives the reports from everybody else who's giving it the messages. So that aspect of consciousness, as the consciousness is kind of sitting in the middle and seeing everything else, this is why it's so easy to take consciousness as a self, because it's hard to see it. Consciousness is the seer, and it's not easy to see the seer. Yeah? How do we see the seer? Well, get a mirror. And our mirror is our meditation and our reflection in meditation. And through meditation, we clean our mind, and mind becomes like a mirror, and we can start to catch a glimpse almost off to the side, like in the corner of our eye, start to catch a glimpse of what this consciousness is. Like, what is it that's seeing all of those other things? But this is very subtle. It's philosophically subtle, and it's experientially extremely subtle to be able to really see what consciousness is. Yeah? So this is the first thing to bear in mind. So when we're thinking, and just remember, just like as a basic or naive principle, everything that you think you know about your mind is nama. All right? All your thoughts, all your ideas, all your emotions, all your opinions, and so on and so forth, this is all nama. And even like you can see this in modern times, in, say, things like discussions of AI and artificial intelligence and so on. You know, the things that they're talking about are always nama. Like Alan Turing said, well, we can tell if a computer is conscious, is intelligent, if we can talk to it, and we can't tell whether it's a human or a computer, right? So it's defining intelligence in terms purely of nama. And all of the discussions of artificial intelligence and things like that all miss the point of vijnana, which is actually what matters. Now, vijnana consciousness is kind of dismissed as this kind of ephemeral epiphenomenon that kind of magically arises from the brain but doesn't really have anything to do with anything. Whereas from a Buddhist point of view, consciousness is the heart of everything and it's what matters most. So this is why vijnana is so hard to see, and why the insight into vijnana, the understanding that even this is impermanent and conditioned, this is the crucial difference between the Buddha's teaching and the teaching of the Upanishads. Because great as the Upanishadic sages were, and the Buddha had tremendous respect for them, we know from the story, the first thing he wanted to do after enlightenment was to teach Alarika Lama and Ludhika Ramaputta. He knew how profound their understanding and their experience was. But even they didn't see this very subtle point. So this is the first thing, the distinction between nama rupa and vijnana. Everything that you've seen in your mind that you think your mind is nama, okay? Unless you've had deep insight in meditation that allows you to catch a glimpse and an understanding of vijnana. Otherwise, it's very, I'm just making a generalization here, but for most people, what they think their mind is their nama, not their vijnana. Okay, that's the first point I want to make. Second point I want to make is that often in modern Buddhism, Namarupa is translated as mind and body. Now, that's in certain, as I've said, it has different meanings in different contexts. And in some contexts, that's not a, you know, it's not an incorrect translation. However, as somebody who has a background in Western philosophy, I think it's an unfortunate way of thinking about it, because it introduces a bunch of fallacies and philosophical problems that are alien to Buddhism. If we're not familiar with the history of philosophy, then we may be not aware of what a minefield this is. But it's truly one of the most intractable problems in Western philosophy. And it's a problem that Buddhists have not had to deal with, it because we come from a different set of assumptions. So let us not make Buddhism messed up by naively importing problems from Western philosophy. Okay? Why is this an issue, and how does this problem come about? Well, they're always interesting to think of these things in terms of the most simple and obvious point of origin for them. Okay? So think about, say, the Bible, one of the great sources of Western philosophy. In the Bible, God creates Adam, and then he's got a bunch of mud lying down there, and then he breathes life into Adam. Huh? Breathes life into him. This is the essence of the mind-body problem. You have two completely separate kinds of things, which you then somehow have to unite. If we say that our mind is one thing and our body is another thing, how do we actually get them to stick together? Right? Do we use like a metaphysical super glue to somehow bond these two things together? How do we do it? Like, what was the God doing that he took a spirit which is somehow intrinsically separate from the body and kind of united with it? Huh? So these are the kinds of problems, and philosophers have been wrestling with this for centuries, and most famously Descartes, but also so many who have wrestled with this, and modern Western philosophy is still in the thrall of this idea. And the whole problem with it is based on a ridiculous assumption. That's not how human bodies work. Human bodies work, like the Buddha said, as a Savijnanakaya, as a conscious body. And right from conception, there are these two elements which are there, the physical growth and the mental and the conscious growth, and they slowly and gradually grow in complexity together. There's a relation between these different aspects. And this is a fundamentally different way of viewing our sentient body. Okay, let me phrase the whole thing another way. From the point of view of dualistic philosophy, mind and body are two separate things, or mind and spirit, or mind and soul, or whatever you want to call it, body and soul, body and spirit, whatever you want to call it. These are two separate things, and we have to somehow figure out how to unite them. From a Buddhist point of view, our fundamental experience is a mixture of mental and physical phenomena. Think about it. Think about what's happening with you right now. You can see things. You can hear things. Right? You can feel things in your body, but you also have emotions. You also have thoughts. You have perceptions. And all of those things are all happening all the time. So the Buddha didn't start with a metaphysical assumption about what are the fundamental things in the universe. Right? He didn't start out by saying there is matter and there is mind and how are we going to stick them together. He started out by looking how his experience actually is. And our experience is actually this whole mixture of things. David Kalapahana, Buddhist philosopher, memorably described it as the big blooming confusion. And that's pretty much how it is. We see all of this mess of stuff, which is sort of partly organized, and we try to keep it partly under control. And much of our life is spent trying to pretend to others that we're actually a lot more in control than we really are. And but we're sitting there in a meeting and our minds off thinking about things a million miles away, or, you know, you're kind of in the shower and having a shower, and then you think, what am I doing here? Why am I in the shower? And all of these things happen to us because this is our fundamental reality. So the fundamental reality is not a fixed state from which we have to build things up. The fundamental reality is a network The fundamental reality is the connection. Chakuncha paticha rupe cha upajati chaku vinyanam kiranang sankati paso. Depending on eye and forms, arises eye consciousness. The coming together of the three is contact. Yeah? This is how the Buddha described experience, that those multiplicity and duality of elements is right there from the beginning. And our experience is the interrelation and the connection between those things. Now, once we realize this, then we can start to tease out these different aspects. So we can start to say, oh, hang on, sight is like a thing outside of us, right? Sight has this quality. It's like, it seems like it's something outside of us. And that's different from our eye or from our experience, which is inside of us. And similarly, we can say, for example, sound also is something, this is something that seems to come from outside, whereas our ear and the experience of that sound, the consciousness of that sound, is something that's happening inside. Yeah. And not only is the experience of the sound that something is happening inside, but our understanding of the meaning of words, again, comes subsequent to that. The external sounds, the hearing of it, then the understanding, the meaning of the words. These are all dependent on each other. And so what we're doing is that we're applying our understanding to what is a network of confused and interrelated things. And we're teasing out the relations and looking at it and trying to understand it in different ways. This was the Buddha's approach. Rather than, so from a Buddhist point of view, to express it more simply, from a Buddhist point of view, we don't begin with fundamental things. We begin with fundamental relations. Yeah, connections are fundamental, not things. Yeah? So this idea, so what that tells us is that our mind and our body are constantly interrelated and interconnected at a fundamental level. And this then brings us on to the final part of the talk, which I wanted to talk about, which was the practical aspects of this. Now, this interrelation and interconnection between the mind and the body, between nama and rupa, and between the things that we think, the things that we perceive, the things that we imagine, and then the things that we experience as part of the physical realm. This interconnection is fundamental to the experience of meditation. Now, I'm just going to take a simple example, and I'm sure most of you are probably familiar with it, is mindfulness of breathing. And, you know, I'm sure most of us have done at least some mindfulness of breathing practice. And if you haven't, you don't have any excuse, okay? Especially if you're on lockdown or whatever, shut down Netflix and do some meditation, all right? And also don't watch YouTube too much, right? You can watch the Buddhist channel on YouTube, but only one a day, okay? And then you have to do some meditation. Don't spend a whole time watching even Buddhist talks on YouTube. Do some meditation. Okay, so, and when you meditate, right, what happens? You experience a physical thing, okay? The feeling of the breath. Yeah? Now, that feeling of the breath, when you begin to meditate, is not isolated because you also feel your posture, right? You feel, how do I feel when I'm sitting here? You feel maybe the tightness in your belly if you feel any tension. Maybe you feel your brows furrowing, or maybe you feel relaxed, or whatever it is your posture is. Maybe you feel like a soreness in your legs or something. But, and within that, you feel this gentle feeling of the breath. And the breath as a physical feeling is very subtle. Right? It's not something which normally grabs our attention. Subtle feeling. In and out. Essential feeling of the breath. And so we have to direct our attention a little bit to that feeling of the breath to be able to know, oh, this is what's happening. Yeah, this feeling of the breath is there. Now, why do we do this? Like most of us do meditation because we want to be more peaceful, because we want to calm our mind down. Why is it that we focus on something physical in order to calm our mind down? Well, it's because, as I said before, the fundamental thing is the relation. And it's because if you want to calm your mind down by focusing on your thoughts, good luck with that. Because your mind will just get distracted and confused. We don't have a grounding point. So our body, physical things, tend to be more stable than the mental things. Right? The mind is changing very quickly. The body is changing somewhat less quickly. So when we pay attention to the breath, we pay attention to this much more constant rhythm. Yeah? Again and again and again. And one breath is a little bit different from the next, but only a little bit, not that very much. And as you go deeper into meditation, you start to notice that your thoughts will affect your breath. And if you're in meditation and you feel, let's say you feel distracted, you realize, oh, hang on, I was supposed to prepare this report for work tomorrow and I haven't done it and I'm going to get in trouble from my boss. And you start to get anxious and you'll notice that that affects your breath. Your breath will become tight and it will become unpleasant. You say, okay, I'll do the report afterwards. You're still doing my meditation. Okay, calm down. And you come back to your meditation. And then, so your mind is affecting your breath, but your breath is also affecting your mind. And when you can connect with that, you realize that actually this thing that we thought was just a physical flow of air, there's a lot more to it than that. Because it almost seems like the breath has this natural soothing effect. It feels like this gentle reminder. And you begin to notice that it's not just its neutral feeling, but it's very pleasant. And you feel the breath, and the breath is like a cool breeze on a hot day. Or it's like the gentle lapping of the waves on the shore. It's like this very soft feeling, which is bringing some sense of soothing and calm to you. And of course, that's not an accident. The breath has that function physiologically. If you from the moment that we're born to the moment we die, we are breathing. And if you stop breathing for a minute, try it, see how calm you get. And we have very quickly that fear of death comes, that terror, that anxiety comes. And our breath is there our whole life, reassuring us you are still alive. You are still alive. Gently, it's doing its job. It's just in the background reminding us. And so it's comforting us. It's soothing us. And it's evolved to have this sort of psychophysiological role. And so you can see that meditating on the breath has these different aspects of nama and rupa in it. Right? It's partly our idea about it. It's partly our concept of it. It's partly a physical thing. And it's not easy to be able to see this. And we only can start to understand this when we go deeper into meditation and stay with that experience for a long time. And we feel that soothing feeling of the breath. And then as we go deeper into meditation, it becomes even more curious because the breath starts to shine. It starts to get a light inside of it and it starts to feel blissful. You have this like pleasurable sense of bliss that can come through and permeate your body from the breath. And you feel like it's just taking away all of the suffering and distress in your body. How is that happening? Why is it that the breath does this? Again, it comes back to this understanding of nama rupa, of the interdependence of the mind and body, about how our physical aspects of who we are and mental aspects of who we are like this from the beginning. So the more we calm our breath, the more we calm our mind. And we experience that as a pleasure. And when that pleasure happens and the contentment happens, the mind is still. And when the mind is still, it starts to see better. The mind is a knowing machine. And when we meditate, it learns to know better. And when the mind knows better, that's why it starts to shine. It looks like a light because there's a light inside your mind because your mind is being cleared of all of the darkness, all of the things that are cluttering up. Of course, in Buddhism, we call these the hindrances, the five hindrances. And as those hindrances fall away and are left behind, then the mind starts, well, the mind looks a bit like this window that I've got shining behind me in the background, in the background here. So just for the record, that is just a window, okay? That's not anything. So this is how this works. So our body, so when the Buddha was teaching about this, nama, rupa, and vijnana, he's not just teaching it as an abstract philosophical context. He's teaching it as something which is a foundation for the whole system of meditation and how we approach meditation and understanding about why meditation works. So in doing this meditation in this way, we're experiencing this peacefulness of mind. The nama becomes quiet. For example, you know, you know that in meditation when your thinking starts to become quiet, yeah? And your thinking starts to settle down, your emotions start to settle down. These are all the aspects of nama, but also your knowing becomes more clear. And we start, and that's your vijnana. Now, when we start to meditate, our vijnana starts to become more clear, but in odd little ways that we don't really notice, okay? So one of the most common ways is when you get itchy, right? Now, you and I, everybody gets itchy. You walk around life, get itchy, maybe scratch it, maybe don't or whatever, but it's not a big part of your life, right? Nobody thinks, unless you've got some kind of, you know, disease or something, nobody thinks much about itches. But when you meditate, oh my goodness, that itch is like so bad and I've just got to scratch it. And you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, and it's like this incredible overpowering thing. And when meditators experience this, they experience it as an obstacle. They think that this itch is distracting. I want to scratch it, but I also want to stay still. And so it creates this sense of conflict. But that's not the right way to look at it. You should see the itch as a good sign, because the itch is telling you that your consciousness is starting to work better. You are more aware of that itch than you were before. That's how your meditation is working. Same thing with thoughts. When people start to meditate, the first thing they say is, oh, I'm thinking so much. And they're like, oh, this is a problem. No, that's not a problem. That's an insight. You were already thinking too much beforehand. You just didn't know it. And now you meditate and you understand, oh, actually, my mind is thinking all the time. Yes. That's why you meditate. So don't think, oh, my mind is thinking, therefore it's a problem and I can't meditate. No, that's why we're there. Yeah, that's like somebody who starts to do exercise, right? And they go for a jog, they come back and they're panting and sweating and they're saying, oh, I'm so out of shape, I couldn't possibly do exercise. No, you're already out of shape. That's why you do the exercise. Yeah? Somebody who's not panting when they come back from the run doesn't need to go for a run. Right. So the mind is becoming more peaceful and our vijnana is starting to become more clear. The things which formerly were too subtle, too small, which would escape our notice, they become apparent to us. And we start to see those little things and realize how important they are, right? To realize that each of these things has that same characteristic. They are often unpleasant. They are changing. Yeah? And they also have other strange characteristics as well. For example, if you're suffering from an itch in your meditation, you might think, well, I want to focus on that. I'm going to be mindful of that itch. And you try to be mindful of it, and it seems to be not there anymore. Kind of seems to go away. It seems almost as if it's empty. So when you're meditating and you're starting to see these things, this is where that wisdom is starting to grow. And that wisdom that sees that all of these things, yeah, the sights, the sounds, all of the consciousness, nama rupa, all of these things actually are impermanent. All of these things are conditioned. All of these things are empty. And your mind will go deeper and deeper into insight and be able to let go of all of these things. And so the teaching of nama rupa and teaching of mind and body is there to give us a conceptual clarity and understanding of how the world works. But that conceptual clarity and understanding is not just there as a theory. It's there because that theory informs how we go about practicing meditation. And when we can apply that theory in our meditation and we can experience that within our own physical and mental reality, then we can move towards letting go. And that is the purpose of the Buddha's teachings.